For the week of April 15th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 407, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, at my local Staples store, I'm Michael Giltz.
Why are you at the local Staples store? You mean the office supply store, right?
Exactly, because as people who watch the news know, our offices were raided over the weekend while you were away. They came in and took everything. So we got to buy new files, new folders, new paper, new payoff checks. So it's a bit of a mess around here, but we'll be okay. But we're not the only ones who got raided. Obviously, the president's lawyer got raided. So did Rupert Murdoch. The Fox Network Group in London had their offices raided by the European Commission. They're investigating them for corruption over TV rights to sports. Are they bribing people? Is there collusion? What's going on? It's not just focused on Fox, but a lot of different people, because angling for sports rights is a huge, huge business. So they were raided as well. And today the bookstores are being raided because James Comey, the former FBI director, his book drops today, his memoir, A Higher Loyalty. An interesting factoid. Since the new year began, 2018, every single book topping the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list has been linked to Trump in some way, always unflattering. There was Fire and Fury, then Russian Roulette, then Dear Madam President, which was by one of Hillary Clinton's communications directors, and now, presumably this week, A Higher Loyalty by James Comey.
We need to write a book.
We need to get raided some more. I thought it would be good publicity. Hey, the Showbiz Sandbox offices were raided.
Yeah. Well, I can actually, if you need any incriminating evidence, I could make some up. If we need to, you buy the files, folders, and staples. I'll buy the incriminating evidence.
Just put your little diary in there. It'll be plenty.
Ah, perfect.
I'm confused though. Your voice, it sounds so sonorous and relaxed, and I don't know, like it's got a new edge to it. And your skin is cleared up. It looks like flawless. And my God, I feel like you've grown 2 inches. You look taller. You have sort of a superior air about you too. Now I get it. You saw Beyonce's performance at Coachella, and you're never going to let us forget.
Nope. Every time I meet somebody now, I'm going to, introduce myself as the person who was at the show that Beyonce put on at Coachella.
And we'll all know what you mean.
Yes, exactly.
So when she listens to the show to hear what you say about her performance, and I know she's on pins and needles, what else will Beyonce hear about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we go on a rampage through the entertainment news of the past week, just like Dwayne Johnson went on a rampage at the worldwide box office. Netflix is officially skipping Cannes, and the famed film festival announced its official lineup. Oddly, they made no effort to support films by Amazon and others to show streaming services are actually welcome. And MoviePass, they haven't let us down either. For the umpteenth week in a row, they've unveiled yet another subscription plan. Speaking of festivals, as you pointed out, Michael, we'll also be talking about this year's Coachella, or as it was renamed during last weekend's event, Beychella. During Book Filter, Michael goes back to the future and tells us what books coming out the week of October 2nd are worth optioning. In sexual misconduct news, Brett Ratner, the filmmaker, was dumped once and for all by Warner Brothers, and the Pulitzer Prize recognized the investigative journalism by the New York Times and the New Yorker that brought down Harvey Weinstein. That may be the last award Harvey is connected to for quite a while. On Inside Baseball, we look at two court rulings that could have a big impact if they're upheld on appeal. One involves the online streaming of rock concerts. The other involves stockholders suing Netflix over performance-based bonuses. Hey, should I ask for straight cash when I re-up my deal for Showbiz Sandbox, or just go with the performance-based bonus?
No, I'd go with cash.
Okay. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. That's where we start our chart. Then from Box Office Prop, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, China Insider Daily, you name it. And this week we have 24 films on the chart. To make the chart, I'm sorry, 23. To make the chart, the worldwide box office chart, your film needed to gross at least $2.3 million. That was to make the chart at all. If you wanted to make the top 10, you had to gross at least $7 million. And if you wanted to be the number one film in the world, you had to gross $150 million, because that's what happened for Rampage, the new film starring Dwayne Johnson. It made $150 million. on its opening weekend. A strong, solid start for a film that cost $120 million to make. And people are now saying Dwayne Johnson is the biggest star in the world.
Well, for right now, I believe he is, don't you think?
Absolutely.
I think he should run for president as he continues to threaten.
He thinks so, too. At number two is A Quiet Place, the horror flick, which I saw over the weekend, actually. $55 million this weekend, $150 million worldwide. It's just about to pass the $100 million mark in North America. Actually, it's already done it because we had the Monday grosses already. We're recording on Tuesday this week because Sperling was at Coachella, as he will never let us forget. So it grossed $100 million in North America. It's now grossed $50 million overseas, and I continue to predict that this movie is going to equal, if not do better worldwide overseas than it did in North America, because this is just a hugely successful movie, and I think it really works worldwide because there are no dialogue.
Now, what's remarkable to me about this movie, $32 million in its second weekend.
Yeah, it had a really big, I shouldn't speak too quickly because it's holding really well in North America. I saw it. It was fun. Like Get Out, it's a clever premise, well delivered. It's not a great movie, but it's a fun movie. It's not really a gory flick. It's just suspenseful and tense. It has a family angle. I think it has a much wider appeal than most horror films. It costs $17 million to make, so clearly it's a big success, and it opens in China on May 18th. At number three around the world is another movie I saw over the weekend, Steven Spielberg's Ready Player One, and all I can say is Hook. It reminds me of Hook. That's how bad it is.
Oh.
$45 million on the weekend, $475 million worldwide. And number four is another horror film. It's Blumhouse's Truth or Dare. Their name is now in the title, like Tyler Perry's, and what is this new movie called? Tyler Perry's Annihilation.
No, Acrimony.
Acrimony. I'm sorry. Annihilation is the sci-fi flick, of course. Tyler Perry's Acrimony. Now it's Blumhouse's Truth or Dare. Blumhouse is not a very scary name. Somehow George Romero sounds scary, but Blumhouse sounds like you'd get vegetables there. But they're in the title now. People know Blumhouse equals horror, and their film Truth or Dare had a big opening weekend. $22 million for a movie that cost pittances to make.
And Jason Blum just had a baby. He's the producer that Blumhouse is named after. And he and his wife had their first night out at the premiere. I'm friends with them on Facebook. And they were like, first night out.
And the little child adorably called Chucky. No. I'm sure their child has a normal, happy name. They're not going to continue the horror trend. Congratulations to them. And number five is Blockers. $14 million on the weekend, $52 million worldwide. That movie is in 22 territories, so we'll have to see where it ends up, but it's sure to be a commercial success. And number six is Peter Rabbit, still just under $300 million worldwide. It made another $13 million this weekend. Here's a new movie. It's Taxi 5. This is the long-running French comedy series. It's sort of an action comedy flick. Luc Besson has overseen it from the start. I think it began in like 1998. This is like a 20-year ongoing franchise. The last film was made over a decade ago in 2007. It's about a taxi driver. And then all sorts of action and comic things happen. The new one has opened up. It probably cost maybe $20 million to make. We don't really know. But the last one cost $17 million, and that was a decade ago. So it opened up to $9.5 million in France and one other territory. Now, Belgium doesn't count. Does Belgium count as a separate territory?
Yes, it does.
Ah, so that surely is the two territories that the movie is playing in. And number eight is Black Panther, still making money, $1.313 million worldwide. The soundtrack for that movie? By Kendrick Lamar. At number nine is Pacific Rim Uprising, $280 million worldwide, and it's slowing down. At number 10 is Wes Anderson's movie. That still has a long way to go. That made $7 million on the weekend. It expanded further in North America. It's just under $30 million total, so it has a ways to go before it triples its estimated budget of $25 million, but I'm sure it's going to have legs, and it certainly has good critical reviews.
Now, can we just go back to Pacific Rim Uprising for a second? You know, you and I would probably say that this is not a movie that we expected a sequel to, okay, Pacific Rim. And so we wouldn't expect a sequel to this one. I mean, maybe because we live in North America where the film only made $60 million. However,
no, I think it's because we saw the film's worldwide gross and it was a marginal hit.
Okay.
They felt like they were going to build on it. But it was a questionable gamble, not an unreasonable one, but it was just close enough to having tripled its budget, just enough to look like it might have some fan base. And presumably they saw the numbers of streaming and DVD sales and rentals and said, hey, there's a lot of people who have liked this movie post-theatrical. That's what I assume that they saw or wanted to convince themselves was happening. Were there spin-off books and comic books? Were toy sales good? What was happening to Pacific Rim? Was there a good story to tell? In that case, we could say, okay, yeah, it didn't have a great opening in North America, but it did well around the world, and we can see this fan base building, that there's enough of a desire for a sequel, because sequels can build on the original. But in this case, it just didn't happen. But I don't think it was the craziest thing in the world, and that's even looking at the worldwide box office, not just North America.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was, that's where I was headed.
Yeah. At number 11 is Annihilation, the sci-fi flick. Not doing that well, but it's only in two territories so far. $40 million this weekend, but it did open up in China, where audience said, I don't get it.
But they said it in a different language.
It did indeed. At number 12 is Sherlock Gnomes, $52 million worldwide. And number 13 is Love, Simon. $4 million on the weekend. It's just about to pass the $50 million mark, so that will have tripled its budget. And it still can play in a lot more countries. We'll have to see how that's going to do. Right behind it is its competitor, Compadre. I can only imagine the faith-based film that opened up in North America on the same weekend and has outpaced Love, Simon every step of the way so far. That's at $76 million worldwide. Then there's that Tyler Perry film whose name I got wrong, Acrimony. In fact, if you're getting a divorce, Annihilation might be a good title too. You know, you want your attorney to say, we're going to annihilate your husband or your wife. $3 million on the weekend, $40 million worldwide, by which we mean North America. Number 16 is that faith-based religious biopic, Nothing to Lose. That's at $19 million in Brazil. Below that is Hindi Medium, the Indian film that opened up in China. That's at $31 million worldwide. Chappaquiddick is falling quietly. That made $3 million on the weekend, and that's at $11 million. So none of the Kennedy clan needs to worry about running for office. This isn't going to stay in people's memory for very long. Looking down the charts for something new, Met Opera had a new live performance. It was Louisa Miller, an opera starring Placido Domingo, in what is surely one of his last performances. $2.8 million in eight different territories. And then we have a final film that's new on the charts. It's Champions. It's a Spanish comedy about a pro basketball coach who must perform community service by coaching a team of mentally challenged players. It opened up last weekend, I guess. It's at $5.8 million so far in Spain. We can only hope it's in good taste. But yeah, so Quiet Place has an opening date in China. Annihilation opened in China, and audiences were confused. But the thing to note about this is it's the second film after Logan to get a parental warning in China. In China, every film released must be all audience friendly. It's meant to be seen by everyone, which is a nightmare because you don't make movies for eight-year-old children every day. Logan is very violent. Annihilation is intense. So this film got a parental warning tag, and people see that as a good sign because they think it's an indication the government might be moving towards a rating system so that not every single film must be edited so you can bring your six-year-old child.
Well,
so that
yeah, I mean, if you were to talk to Chris Aronson, the head of distribution at Worldwide Distribution at 20th Century Fox, he'd tell you that the reason that Alien, the last Alien film didn't do so well is because, you know, they cut out the alien. At least it didn't do so well in China. Sorry, I should point that out.
And Khan cut out Netflix. I mean, they said, you can come, you just can't be in competition. And Netflix now has officially said, no thanks. And I think we felt like, you know, Netflix, there's a lot of publicity and attention to get at Khan without being in competition. There's only like 18 films in competition. There are about 500 films, if not more, showing in the market and the festival and new directors and all out of competition and all these other areas. So that seems silly for something like the Orson Welles film that belongs in Khan Classics. That seems silly for a movie that might be a big commercial flick that would work out of competition, like the Star Wars movie Han Solo. But that's their decision. And he gave an interview to Variety and he made a few good points. What I liked was that he said, you know, he feels like film festivals are to help films get discovered so they can get distribution. But under the rules they have now, they can't release their movie day and date worldwide so that everyone can see it. You know, they have to wait because of the French rule where they have to wait 3 years after a film is in theaters before it can be made available for streaming. That's tough. And here's what he said. He said, last year, we were jointly celebrating the art of cinema at Cannes. The divergence is this decision to define art by the business model. In that way, yes, we have diverged. And he's saying, hey, Why are you defending a business model? Why do you care how people see a movie? If we back a movie and make a movie and it's a great movie, a lot of them that go to festivals never get seen in a theater at all. They never get distribution. We're making it available all over the world right away. So why are you harming us?
Right. And I guess you could also make the argument that, well, they're not necessarily backing a business model. They're backing, you know, an art form. A painting is a painting because they actually use paint. They don't, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know,
So a movie is only a movie if it's shown in a movie theater commercially, because many festival films never get shown in the theaters. Some of the best films of the year, I'll say, will be at a film festival. And today that's less true because there's so many more multiplexes. But it was quite often you go to the festival circuit and see a festival film, a wonderful movie that's never going to play in your local theater. And that used to be the case. But now they may play New York and LA and then be available on demand all over the country.
Right.
Does that make it a movie? You know.
Well, I mean, I get Can's point, but I will say this about the French chronology of media. It does need to shorten up. Look, I'm all for windows. Okay, I get it. You know, certainly you have the right to, if you make a film, to be seen in a certain way in a cinema, give it some time to breathe in the cinema. You know, don't...
If you want.
If you if that's your goal. Right. That said, you know, 3 years is a little much.
Yeah, that's got to change. I'm sure that we will see Netflix in competition at Cannes within 5 years.
Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked.
I think something's going to have to change. Either Cannes will say, never mind, or the French industry will say, 3 years is a little crazy. It's hard to change the rules surrounding cinema in France, but it may happen.
It's already beginning. I mean, there's been a conversation that the Ministry of Culture, the culture minister, is kind of looking over the chronology of media and kind of ready to make some changes. It's just what those changes will be remain to be seen.
And so we have a new official lineup at Cannes. They've announced the films that are competing. They will also be adding at least one or two more films in the next few days or weeks before the festival begins. And as in every year, we can say the following arguments occur. People will say there are too many Hollywood films, or there are too few Hollywood films. They'll say too many of the usual suspects. It's boring. Or they'll say, where are the usual suspects? Why isn't Mike Lee in the festival? They'll say Hollywood has too much influence, or French distributors have too much influence. Why was this film rejected? Why was that film not ready? Or did they just not like it? There aren't enough women, and so on and so forth. You know, and here's a changing of the times, though. Cannes made a point of highlighting that one film in competition will be screened in 35 millimeter.
Okay. Alice
Roar Walker's Happy as Lazaro. They're going to show that on celluloid. That's how much the distribution business has changed, that they think, look at that, we have a film on celluloid. That's actually a notable thing to say at Cannes.
Well, Chris Nolan is also screening a 70 millimeter print of 2001.
Ooh, would I love to see that.
Yeah, I mean, that would be nice.
So they made some new changes. One of them, I think, makes a lot of sense. What do you think? They said, we're not going to have any film that world premiered at Sundance or South by Southwest or anywhere else. We'll only have world premieres in our competition. They can't have been seen anywhere else in the world.
To which I would say, you've pretty much always done that anyway.
Thank you. They only have 17 films in competition, though they say they will add at least one or two. They're waiting for some things to either clear legal hurdles or become available or whatever's happening. So, you know, there's the new Spike Lee, the new Jean-Luc Godard, the new Pavlikovsky. I'm sorry, I'm ruining his name. I really liked Ida, which won the Oscar. I really loved Last Resort and My Summer of Love. So I'm looking forward to his film. There are two filmmakers under house arrest, one in Russia, one in Iran. Are you excited? Asghar Farhadi opens the festival. Star Wars, a movie opens up in the middle of the fest out of competition. I thought, wow, they must have a lot of confidence in it. And then I remembered, no, wait. They also showed two of the George Lucas movies in out of competition, and they were terrible.
Yes. I mean, we're talking about, both of the Star Wars films, actually, were not that great.
Two of the three prequels, yeah.
Yeah. And they also showed the last Indiana Jones movie out of competition. And yeah, they show a lot of movies out of competition where you're like, like, you know, Mission to Mars, the Brian De Palma film. So yeah, sometimes the stuff that's out of competition is out of competition for a reason.
Oh, yeah, they were never going to be in competition. No, they're just to bring a little pizzazz and celebrity star power. But there were a lot of familiar names that did not make it into the festival, whether because their film wasn't ready or there were legal troubles like the Terry Gilliam film, Don Quixote. But I was surprised they didn't make an effort to bring in an Amazon film or two. Like they ignored the Mike Lee film. And you would have thought that that would have just been a slam dunk. It's a historical epic. Peter Liu, Mike Lee is always at Cannes, and yet it didn't happen.
Yeah, I don't know why. I mean, Todd McCarthy in Variety said, you know, it very well might be that they actually did see some of these films and went, you know what? They're just not good.
Yeah, that they almost never do. Well, that's surely some of them, but they almost never do that for old favorites. So,
like,
you know,
Jean-Luc Godard?
Right. We know that won't be good. But they've always let those films in, and people have always complained, oh, you know, they always gets in. Oh, he, you know, he's an automatic. If he makes a film, it's a con. And people complain about that. And now this year they don't do it, and people complain about that. You just can't win.
Well, you know what it is that people want to see certain films by certain filmmakers. Nuri Bilge Ceylan, for instance, is Jacques Audiard.
Yes, but every year when they include them, people yell at them and say, you're just including the usual suspects. I understand why. I'd like to see those movies too. But when they do that, people bitch.
You know, it's just going to make Toronto that much more appealing to go to.
And that's what one story said. They said, is Cannes no longer the premier film festival because of the way the season works and how things move so much more quickly now that May is just has never been an ideal time. But in the old days, you could show at Cannes, then leisurely you'd show up in the fall, and then you'd have an Oscar campaign. You know, it sort of worked in the world that we lived in. Films took a while to travel. Buzz took a while to travel. A European film coming to America, this would take a while. Nowadays, everything is so sped up. Cannes feels like it's just way, way too early for some people. Even if they have their film and it's ready, they don't want to debut it in May to the press.
Well, you know, Carol was a film that debuted in Cannes and had a nice little Oscar run just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, well, you know, absolutely. There are always counter arguments, but do you think Cannes is slightly less important than it used to be?
No, I think maybe this year, you know, they just went a different route. And if they're able to go this different route, find films that wind up in the competition, in the award mix, then it'll be right back to where they used to be.
And of course, their job is not to find films that are Oscar ready so much as it is to find great films. If they can just find a film that is in the conversation as a terrific film, that's where they've done their job.
That's right. And then naturally the awards come.
Yeah. And then Lars von Trier may get added back in, even though he was banned for life.
Yes.
From Cannes. Banned for life, at least for a few years.
Yeah, until he makes his next movie.
Certainly, MoviePass had banned AMC for life. They were never going to let people go to those theaters in LA, but they have changed their story. Those theaters are back in. MoviePass is always making news, and they're the cover story in this week's Variety. Variety says they're upending the business, but can they survive? And they point out this is the fastest growing paid entertainment subscription business in history. They've grown faster than Netflix or Spotify or HBO or even Apple Music, which had the power of Apple behind it, not to mention all those credit cards already stored by Apple where all you had to do was click on a button to subscribe to Apple Music.
Well, what I would say is you're not growing that fast. You're a seven-year-old company, okay? So the company is 7 years old, number one.
In 6 months, they went from 20,000 to 2 million.
Okay, that's sure. I mean, if you make something free, yeah, it'll grow really fast. But also, people are used to it now. People are used to subscription services now. Whereas Spotify in 2007 was having to try and convince people that this was a good idea.
Mm-hmm. They revealed a little information. They insist that with ads, you know, more and more studios are advertising their movie on MoviePass, which makes sense. And with revenue sharing that they anticipate, they insist they'll be cash flow positive in 2019.
They talk about a lot of things that like that. They say a lot of things.
And what they want, actually, is they want people to see just over one movie a month. They want the gym model, where they get a lot of people to sign up, but then they don't actually use it as much as they think they will. They want people to say 1.3 movies a month. Then they would be happy, because they estimate for every customer they have, they can generate an extra $6 in ads, ticket sales, which they already get a cut of from a few tiny indie theater chains, and concessions. Now, let's just assume that's true. I pay $10 a month, and they can get my $10 plus an extra $6 by having my eyeballs onto their app. That's $16 a month. Well, guess what? they're losing money on me. I don't think that works. Even they're going to get a lot of people who aren't going to want to go to movies to have to subscribe, because it certainly isn't going to work for someone like me.
Well, like, look, I belong to a gym. Okay. I pay, I think it was $50 a year because I've been a member for so long. Now I think it's up to $125. When it was $50 a year, yeah, I mean, I might have paid, you know, ultimately $10 every time I went, if you were to, you know, amateurize it out. Now, I really do have to question, is it worth it? Because I don't go as much as I should.
Yeah. Well, one curious comment in Variety was they said, quote, whether MoviePass survives or dies, it has undeniably shaken up an industry that hasn't changed much since the silent era. Has the film industry really not changed much since the silent era? I guess they're just describing how you go to the movies and not looking at the whole, you know, VHS, DVD, streaming, digital downloads, worldwide box office, stadium seating, color, sound, 3D, IMAX. I mean, I feel like even distribution has changed a fair amount. You still go into a room, sit down, and watch a movie. But I feel like that's changed a lot. And there's so much of a life for movies beyond the cinema. I think that's part of the business, too. So I don't know about that. But Mitch Lowe said, you know what? People stopped going to see the King's Speech type movies. They're only seeing the comic book films. And we wanted to change that. And I'd say, well, that's true, except for the people who actually saw The King's Speech, which grossed $430 million worldwide.
Well,
so,
I think, not really a good example. I think he's saying that movie did well, okay,
The King's Speech. No, I know, that's bullshit. He's like, well, yeah, they saw that movie, but there were movies like it that they didn't see. No, middle movies and smaller movies are making a lot of money. They always have, even though people say, oh, studios don't want to make those mid-budget movies anymore. Well, they still are, and they're making money. And we can look at the box office chart this week and see it.
Annihilation. Although that hasn't made its money.
A genre flick, you know, but yeah, I mean, it's not the season. This is April, but you know, I think that's not true. Here's another fun detail. AMC reached out to MasterCard. They say, hey, MoviePass, how can they tell people what to do with their MasterCard? They've given them a credit card and told them they can only use it to buy a movie. Is that legal? Doesn't that go against the terms of service? And they reached out to MasterCard and said, hey, are they violating your rules? Just trying to create trouble for them.
And I can tell you that I don't know what the rules are of MasterCard, but there are tons of gift card type services like that where they're not violating the terms of service.
Well, usually if it's a gift card from a credit card, you can use it anywhere that credit card is accepted. A gift card from Macy's you cannot use at Sears, but a gift card that's a Visa gift card or American Express, you can use it anywhere it is accepted.
Right.
But I'm sure MasterCard may just say, we don't care, we're fine with it.
Yeah.
But now MoviePass made a new offer. They have a new subscriber model. Tell us about it.
So I guess because there's not enough different subscription plans that MoviePass offers, they now have one that is, what is it, like $6.95 if you pay for the entire year up front. So it's like $90 a year. I don't know, however many dollars a year it is. And you get iHeartRadio and you get a MoviePass subscription.
No, you're mixing up the two things.
No, okay,
so that was the last subscription offer. Now they have a new limited time offer, which is you pay $30 for 3 months.
Oh, okay. Look, I can't even keep up. Okay, I cover this company. I cover them, and I still can't keep up.
But here's the thing: you only get to see one movie a week.
Oh,
so this subscription offer is $30 a month for 3 months. You only get to see one movie a week, plus you get access to iHeartRadio for that 3 months. So iHeartRadio costs $10 a month, or $13 if you buy it through iTunes, because iTunes charges a surcharge, right? MoviePass costs $7 a month. So you're getting a $17 value for, well, 17 times 3 would be $51. You're getting a $51 value for $30 over those 3 month period. But what happens after that? Unless you sign up, you can't even figure out what goes on. Like, how much do you get charged for iHeartRadio if after the 3 months you keep it? How much do you get charged for MoviePass after 3 months? It's hard to figure it out. And, you know, you would go to the website, you have to actually sign up and pay for it before that's all told to you. So not only is it confusing, oh, suddenly there are, you know, as many movies as you want, one a day, is now only one a week.
Yeah, I would have said, look, I get it. Don't do this. Because you're just confusing. You're muddying the waters. Everybody thinks it's, you know, a monthly subscription. See as many movies as you just don't muddy the waters with this, you know, silly, you know, 3 months only iHeart. It's not worth it.
And if you
go to
the website, you can't even sign up for the program they offered 2 weeks ago. All you can sign up for is this offer.
Oh, so you
which
can't.
Maybe I don't want. I don't want iHeartRadio. So if I said, all right, I'm ready to do MoviePass, and I go to their website, the only option I see, maybe I'm wrong, is this dumb plan for iHeartRadio, which I don't want. So it's just ridiculous. It's just yet another, it just feels like they're throwing everything at a wall to make it stick.
Yeah, they claim it's $150 value, by the way.
Well, yes, I'm not sure how. MoviePass is $10 a month a few weeks ago, so that's 3 months. That's $10. Unless iHeartRadio costs, it's $13 a month, even on iTunes. So that's, you know, $39 plus $30 for MoviePass. So it's 60. How is it? It doesn't make any sense. Plus, they limit the number of movies you can see. I don't know. I like the one size fits all. Like when
by
you
the
go
way,
to cook-
by the way, it's billed quarterly. So it's $30 every 3 months, billed quarterly. So
right, but it's not clear what happens after the first month. Is that for the rest of your life? Are they both remaining the same price? It's not clear. To me, it looked like you were just getting introduced to iHeartRadio. So I don't understand. Is that $30 quarterly forever?
When did they introduce this? Because this is
like 3-5 days ago.
Oh, okay. I've been, you know.
You were at Coachella.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I was at Coachella, and guess what I saw flying around? You know how, like, at some of these big events, whether it's a football game or, you know, some kind of big sporting event, they'll have an airplane flying around with a big banner behind it, you know, an air ad, they call it. MoviePass was one of those air ads. And as I was there, I saw, are you at Coachella? MoviePass sent me a push notification. Come and party with us. Flash party from 3 to 6 on Sunday. I thought, well, first of all, why would I leave the venue to come to, you know, to go 20 miles away to your party? you know, so I was a little confused by that, but I couldn't.
It wasn't at the Coachella site?
No, that's what no, it was like 30 miles. Well, not 30. It was like maybe 15 miles away.
Why would they? What do you mean? Where was it?
In La Quinta, and which is about 15 miles away, and you know, 10
they
to 15
thought they were having a Coachella linked event. They're just saying if you're headed to Coachella, stop by on your way or something.
Yeah, and that, by the way, that happens all the time because where Coachella is held in Indio, California, Indio is the city where it's held, but there are other cities around it like Palm Desert, Rancho Mirage, La Quinta, where people stay. So it's not unheard of to hold events in those, you know, neighboring cities. But to do it from 3 to 6, that's kind of like prime get into the venue time. So I don't know why they thought
pretty
that.
Dumb.
Yeah.
Yet another dumb marketing move by MoviePass,
you know,
which I like. I have it. I used it twice this weekend. Thank you, MoviePass. So, you know, I think this is the year that Coachella is clearly, there's Glastonbury in the UK, and there's Coachella. That became the number two festival around the world, I think, this year. It's just that big. It's huge. It sounds like they expanded. Every venue is bigger, holds more people, which may be a good or a bad thing, depending on your point of view. I don't think it ever had a real intimate feel to any areas too much. Now it's just like you want to see a big act here or see another act there. There's lots of people everywhere. It feels like it's really, it's getting big, isn't it?
Well, yeah, okay. First of all, I guess... Coachella, to give you some sense of where Coachella is in the you know, popular culture landscape, and Michael, you and I talked about this right before we recorded, in Black Panther at the very end of the movie, there, and I'm not giving anything away here, there's a kind of a joke about, when you said you were taking me to California, I thought you meant taking me to Disneyland or Coachella. The fact that you could have a joke like that in a movie that's going out around the world means that, you know, Coachella is in the popular mindset. You know, not just here in California, not just in the United States, but pretty much around the world. It is a worldwide, we're known worldwide.
Absolutely. Though I would point out the context of that joke means if you know what Disneyland is, you can understand, oh, that must be something like Disneyland. So it works even if you don't quite get it. Your mom and dad get it too,
right?
In context.
Yes. And as far as, and I've been going to Coachella since like 2002, third year that they held the event. Actually, it was the maybe the third year they held the event. And, you know, they have taken over the polo field where it is held, the polo grounds, and they've expanded it. They've pushed stages farther out. They've allowed for 62,000 additional people to come in. It was always crowded. I'm not saying that they've let those people in, but they've you know,
got more room for everyone.
They've got more room for everyone. They moved. So for people like me who had been in the past, it was very disorienting because you had no idea where things were. They moved stages around. The Sahara tent, which is the EDM and electronica tent, was like an airplane hangar. I mean, literally the size of an airplane. It was huge. And they changed the footprint of it so that it, instead of it being, you know, going the long way, it went, it was wide instead of, long.
Even though they had more people and bigger venues, did it feel less crowded because there was more room?
At times, yes. However, when the weekend was showing, no. I mean, it definitely is crowded. So it felt a little less crowded, but you knew the crowd was there.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I don't know how to, maybe I'm not presenting that properly, but you knew there were as many, if not more people than in years past. But there were times where you thought, okay, it's crowded, but I can actually walk across the field here.
And not get crushed.
Correct.
And of course, this isn't Burning Man. There were lots of ads this time, weren't there? For the first time, it really feels branded.
Well, that's been going on for a while. It's slowly been ramping up. One of the things Coachella always kind of prided itself on was no sponsorships. You know, Heineken always had like a little tent there. And by little tent, it was like a booth, like a carnival booth off to the side where you can kind of go and rest in the shade. But then they provided all the beer, you know, so that was kind of like their giveaway was, oh, you can have a little booth over here and people can rest in the shade and there can be DJs and a DJ booth over there. You know, radio stations would have a booth or two here and there, but you had to kind of search for them. They weren't very prominent. There was not a lot of marketing around them. Now, mm-hmm. It's the same thing. There's not a lot of, you know, you kind of have to search them out. They're not as prominent. You kind of, if you can catch them out of the corner of your eye, but Amex has a little area. Sephora, the makeup and I guess perfume.
Okay, so
store.
There's lots of advertising, lots of people there around. Yeah.
But you can't, it's not overly done. It's not too much yet. And
okay.
I say yet because you can kind of feel it coming.
Well, you saw a lot of acts. You discovered a new band like Cherry Glazer and Greta Van Fleet. St. Vincent rocked out. David Byrne's show was really cool. War on Drugs was perfect. We don't care. We don't care. Eminem was weak. We don't care, Sperling. All we want to know about is Beyonce.
Yeah, I mean, as you know, Michael, I know a few Beyonce songs. I'm not her biggest fan, not because I don't like her. I don't know a lot of her music. And I thought, okay, I'll go to the first four songs and then leave. And nobody else was playing. So contractually, she must have had that in her contract. But this show, I guess Michael Wood of the LA Times said, look, there's really no other way to say it. Beyonce's headlining performance Saturday night at the Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival was one of the most impressive things I've seen in 20 years of professional show going. Now, the reason I said that is because John Caramanica of the New York Times started his review of the show saying, let's just cut to the chase. There's not likely to be a more meaningful, absorbing, forceful, and radical performance by an American musician this year or any year soon than Beyonce's headlining set at the Coachella Valley Music and Arts Festival on Saturday night. Literally, right, it's like they were cribbing one another.
I texted you and you were like, I said, please tell me you saw her performance is the great, you know, and you're like, it was as good as the review said, to which I said, that's not possible. Because basically they said it's the greatest artistic production in all of history that we'll ever have or ever will be. And they should erase Mount Rushmore and put her on there all alone.
Yeah, Trevor Noah said she blew the roof off of Coachella. And I know what you're thinking. Coachella is an outdoor festival, but she brought a roof just to blow it off. That's how good she is.
Yeah. So it was the first time you saw her live?
It was the first time I'd seen her live, but I've seen a lot of events at Coachella, a lot of acts, and there have been some of the most memorable live events I've seen have been at Coachella, like Arcade Fire in 2011, dropping hundreds and hundreds of big, giant beach balls that were bouncing around the crowd, and then all of a sudden, the beach ball started lighting up in sync with the music. It was unbelievable, and and you know, it was a social media moment. It was unbelievable, and you know, just one event after another like that, and yet this topped them all. If I were Eminem, I would have said, yeah, I'm canceling. I'm not showing up because he played the next night. There was just no way for him to compete with that. It was, there were 100 dancers, musicians.
Nobody in history will compete with it. Nobody can compete with it ever.
I mean, a brass and string band, drumline, baton twirlers. Her sister came out to twerk with her, you know, like a twerk off at one point, Solange Knowles. And then, of course, there was a Destiny's Child reunion in the middle of it. Kelly Rowland and Michelle Williams showed up. Jay-Z showed up, and he literally strutted across the stage. Like, he was out there for like 5.5 seconds. But she played, I kid you not, for 2 hours. I thought, and that's really long for that kind of show.
For a festival, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, normally it's like 50 minutes, an hour and a half. If you're lucky, you know, you get an hour and a half. But she played for 2 hours. This show was choreographed to within an inch of its life. And what I mean by that is usually, you know, it's a festival show. They have 35, 40 minutes to change the set around. So a band gets off and then you have to bring on the next act, and you have to bring all of their equipment and all of their lighting and all of their, you know, instruments on stage and hook them up and test them. And you don't have a lot of time. So there's not a lot of choreography. There's not a lot of the camera work is always kind of shaky. She knew where every camera was. The cameras were, they were all her own team. They had a steady cam. They had, you know, running cams at the foot of the stage, a huge set, dozens of musicians, dozens and dozens of musicians. It was a spectacle. And the whole time you thought, well, this can't keep going on like this. This can't, you know, this part of the show will end and then it'll kind of turn into a normal show. And it didn't. It just kept going. I mean, one song, I don't know that many songs of hers. I know like maybe a handful. And yet it would still entertain me. I mean, and she knew that people like me weren't going to be up front. And she made the show even better for people in the back than it was in the front. But I have to agree with Michael Wooden and the New York Times critic. It was pretty remarkable.
Now, who they book next year?
That's, I don't know. Now, mind you, she made a point, Beyonce made a point of saying, look, I was supposed to be here last year. I got pregnant. I obviously couldn't do this type of show 7 months pregnant. So thank you for waiting. And thank you for making me the first African-American female to headline Coachella. I don't necessarily know who else they could have gotten to headline in years past. I'm sure they maybe could have found somebody. I don't know who is as big as she is, but she definitely did it up. She did it right. And boy, did she just blew the roof off the place. And I know I'm stealing Trevor Noah's line.
Well, there you go. So that was exciting. It'd be a hard act to follow. You'd hate to be there next week.
Yeah. Well, because of course, I don't know how you kind of follow it up with a repeat performance of the same thing. Yeah, I mean, one kind of trend I saw this year, at least in my own show going, I skipped out on some of the acts that I've seen in years past. So like Fleet Foxes, I didn't go to, but I was seeing a lot of female artists. St. Vincent, you mentioned. I mean, I've seen her a couple times in the past. It was like any other show I've ever seen her do. She totally rocked. I mean, she was like a hard rocker. It was unbelievable. Worth seeing, even if you don't know any of her music. It was that good. David Byrne, he had a whole...
He's not a woman.
He's not a woman, but David Byrne had a whole set where none of the musicians were stationary. So everybody was walking around. It was all dancing and choreographed. He's, you know, former lead singer of Talking Heads, and he's been on his own for decades now. It was a very well put together show, and pretty much... I would say most of the acts I saw were worth catching. But very often what I would do at a show like this or at a festival like this is go from stage to stage. So I would see half of, Alt-J and then go see part of Post Malone. Okay. I couldn't do that because now the stages are too far apart.
Yeah. I would hate to do that. If I want to see an act, it's like going to the movies at Cannes. I don't want to see half an hour of a movie. I want to see the movie.
Right. And you know, toward the end of each Coachella, I would kind of just go, oh, screw it. I'm just going to stay here for the whole thing because you kind of get tired of running back and forth between them. So you do that for the first day. And then by the second day, you're like, I'm just going to stay in one place. But yeah, now they've made it very difficult to do that. And you really have to make your decisions.
So will you go back next year?
It depends on who's really? Playing. I'm getting a little
old. After your life-changing experience of Beyonce, you may not go back next year?
You know, it's funny because you kind of leave on Saturday night going, well, I guess it's all worth it because I came, I saw, I was there for the show. You know, this is the thing everybody's going to be talking about for years to come. And you think, I got to be there next year. You know, after a while you realize, wow, you know, you're not as young as some of the teenagers who wear basically decals as their outfits. You know, one thing that I will say, though, that I've noticed is at the end of some sets, Alt-J did this, and so did Portugal the Man. Portugal the Man was hilarious because they came out, and the first thing they say on their big screen, they're playing the main stage, which is huge. I did not think that they were going to be capable of capturing that crowd. I couldn't believe it. I thought 50,000 people, as people are showing up for Odessa and then later Eminem, they were all into it. They actually came out and said, hey, we're not really good at stage banter, so our manager gave us a whole bunch of text to put up on the screen during our show. that was written on the screen. And so they had things like, you know, if you were here to see Odessa, which was the act following, you're a little early. Or everyone in the back, just nod along to the music. Trust us, we're killing it up here. And then towards the end, they were like, we better wrap this up so we can go see Migos in the Sahara tent. I mean, I guess you had to be there because they were very funny.
The performance was good.
Performance was good. But then afterwards, the same thing with Alt-J, they put up on screen all of the credits, who was in the band, who did the lighting, who did the visuals, who some of the influences for the music were. It was like credits to their set.
Well, that's cool. Give a little shout out to the people that worked on it.
Yeah, I really appreciated that because I was like, oh, yeah, look at all the effort that went into this.
I wonder if they make it available online or elsewhere.
I'm sure they do.
Okay. Well, I'm sure Sunday we'll have books about Coachella. I know we've already got books about Beyonce. Sounds like we could have an entire book just about her performance at Coachella.
I bet you're right, which means it must be time for Book Filter, where you dive into the new releases and bring us a book that's ready for its close-up. What have you got for us this week, Michael?
Well, this week I've jumped back to the future. I'm looking at October 2nd. A friend of mine, Patty Callahan Henry, has a new book coming out on October 2nd. She writes literary fiction, women's fiction, romance books, however you want to categorize them. And she has her first historical novel coming out on October 2nd. It's called Becoming Mrs. Lewis, and it's about the love affair between C.S. Lewis and the American woman that he fell for and then who died tragically. That story has been told mostly from his point of view and towards the end when she's dying, as in Shadowlands, the Broadway play. This book is about her point of view. So she's got a new publisher, a new book coming out October 2nd. She's very excited, and she wanted to know what other authors were coming out that week. So I went ahead to October 2nd, went through all the books and made a list for her, showed her all the people coming out. And in doing that, I discovered some titles. I thought, you know what? We always tell you these are the books you should option, but they often get optioned before they hit the stores. So you got to jump on them early. So here's books that are already picked up. The publisher's got them set for release date, and I think you should consider them for optioning. One is Heresy by Melissa Lenhart. She's done a couple books that are westerns with female protagonists. This one sounds like a blast. It's about the first and only all-female outlaw gang, the Parker LaCour gang. They're run off their ranch by a greedy cattleman, and they've only got like two choices. They can get married, or they can lie on their backs, you know, be a prostitute. I mean, it's women in the West. Or, of course, they have the third option, becoming outlaws. And so they become outlaws. They start knocking over places. They're really successful, and the newspapers refuse to cover them. They can't give these out-of-control women any good press, even though the press usually loves outlaws. But the Pinkertons are on their trail. The author pitched it as Thelma and Louise meets the Magnificent Seven. She even has a hashtag, #TLM7. Very clever, really good hook, really good idea. I think, you know what? I already want to see that movie. And then here's another book. It's
called You Might Have to Make It.
Exactly. I mean, that sounds like a lot of fun, doesn't it?
Yeah. Somebody
Women
said,
in the Wild West.
How do we park closer at Coachella? I said, yeah, learn how to play the guitar, spend 10 years forming a band. Yeah.
Okay, maybe I should start optioning these books. I might option this one. It's called When the Men Were Gone by Marjorie Herrera Lewis. It's based on a true story, and it's about a woman during World War II who lives in Texas. All the men are gone, of course. They're all at war, a lot of them. And they're out of high school football coaches. She knows more about football than most men. She learned it at her daddy's knee. She knows the game inside and out. And during World War II, she became the first high school football coach in Texas history. Obviously, the first woman to do that. Everyone's against her. The newspapers, other women, other coaches, even some of the players. But she knows the game and she wins everybody over and the team rallies behind her. I mean, this just sounds like a slam dunk, doesn't it? I mean, awesome. You got the World War II setting, women on the home front, football, Texas. It's got it all. The only thing I'll say is that it has a really bad cover. It doesn't indicate Texas or football in any way, shape, or form. I think it's a big miss. It sort of just looks like your typical women's fiction romance novel. Other than that, that's my caveat as far as its commercial appeal. But I think that's a hell of a story.
Well, you know, between Coachella and all the great female acts there and these books, I think Women Are the New Black.
That's right, which brings us to sexual misconduct, the part of the show where we talk about the issues that are still arising that will continue to arise for many years to come. What happened to Brett Ratner?
Well, it's what didn't happen to him, and that is Warner Brothers did not renew his contract as a writer-director. His production company, basically, no longer has a contract with Warner Brothers.
He has no home. 11 women so far have charged Ratner with sexual misconduct, including actresses like Olivia Munn and Natasha Henstridge. He denies it, but Warner Brothers doesn't want anything to do with him. It's going to be interesting to see what happens to people like Kevin Spacey and Brett Ratner down the road, because they've made a lot of money for a lot of people. Are people going to say, oh, it's been a year, let's just work with Kevin Spacey? We'll find out. But we have found out the Pulitzer Prize winners, and sexual misconduct pops up there as well. The New York Times and Ronan Farrow of The New Yorker shared a Pulitzer Prize for their investigative journalism that took down Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, now I'm wondering, it is the journalists that win this award, correct? Even though it's the outlets that win
it. It depends. You know, sometimes it goes to the entire newsroom. Sometimes it goes to a team. Sometimes it goes to editors and the journalists. You know, it just depends on the situation and how the story was told and who did it. Because there's some multimedia stories. There was one, I forget the paper, but they did a story about 1 week in the opioid epidemic, and they covered everything. And they had multimedia stuff. They had videos. They had visuals. They had all sorts of things. It was a huge project. The entire newspaper was devoted to this, literally. So it goes to a lot of people in that case. New Yorker, I don't know. I mean, The New Yorker has won a Pulitzer Prize, but I assume Ronan gets a statue to take home. He'll be the one picking it up. But, you know, I don't know how that works, really. I've never won a Pulitzer. But
well, it
damn,
says here, the New York Times for reporting led by Jody Cantor and Megan Toohey, and the New Yorker for reporting by Ronan Farrow.
Right. So, but it may go to editors as well. And other times there are stories, though, with 20 people on it or 50. So it doesn't necessarily, it's not like the Oscars where you have to announce who gets to get the producing credit.
Right.
I think the Pulitzers decide that. But we know they won the Pulitzer Prize. And damn, we know Kendrick Lamar won one as well.
In fact.
Exactly. That's my joke. He won the Pulitzer Prize for music. It's the first time that has gone to a work that's not classical or jazz.
That is huge.
Yes, it is. Between Beyonce and Kendrick Lamar, it's a big week for African Americans.
Well, if it's a big week for African Americans, maybe you can tell us. There's no way to tie this together. I've just totally botched the transition here, but it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, Netflix is still going strong. They added 7.4 million new subscribers around the world, and we do mean around the world since more than 5 million of them came outside the U.S. That set a new record for growth in the first quarter. It also means Netflix now has 125 million paid subscribers around the world. No wonder they're spending some $8 billion on content in 2018. Now, if only they'd spend some of that on podcasts. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. They're still barreling ahead. And I'm starting to see all these sort of bundling deals. Netflix is being bundled by Comcast into their Xfinity package. Hulu is bundled with Spotify. If you subscribe to Spotify, you can get access to Hulu for just a couple extra bucks a month. Everybody wants to make deals with everyone else to reach more and more people. That's the game, isn't it? And Netflix is winning it.
Yes. Now, are you at the a police station, because I keep hearing lots of sirens.
I am 14 stories up and they're not going to take me. I won't go back. I'm afraid they're coming to raid these offices as well. You keep moving, they keep raiding.
Okay. Well, maybe the police are coming for Lindsey Buckingham because Fleetwood Mac has fired Lindsey Buckingham, or at least
he didn't break the law.
I know, but it was a transition, so
okay.
You know.
Okay.
And as you can tell from my previous transition, I'm not good at them. Now, Lindsey Buckingham, he's not going on tour with the band. That's basically what the story is here. And it took not one, but two people to replace him. Tom Petty's longtime guitarist, Mike Campbell, and singer Neil Finn of Crowded House. The bad blood started when Buckingham dissed a cash grab by Fleetwood Mac after the band did two giant shows, even though Buckingham and McVie were touring with their duets album. Still, they showed up and grabbed the cash. But when the Mac was looking to tour, Buckingham said he wanted to focus on solo material. And the Mac said, well, have fun. And they're planning to go on tour without him. They wish him all the best, of course. Their last tour grossed more than $200 million. I think Lindsey Buckingham might suddenly be rethinking his solo career. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. It's the end of an era for a band that knows nothing but the ends of eras. You know, Christine McVie left and she came back. Obviously, when Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham joined in the mid-70s, that powered that band to a whole new level, changing them from a blues rock band into the pop powerhouse. I'm sorry I never got to see them with their classic lineup. I love Lindsey Buckingham. He's great, but you know what? John McVie and Mick Fleetwood have been around long before Lindsey, and they're here long after him. But I have to feel good that they replaced him with two people. I feel like if I left this show, there'd be like a team of five paired with you. It'd be like CNN when they have seven people on screen to talk about breaking news. So I hope that when you fire me, that you replace me with at least three people.
It'll be like Clarence Clemons, you know, the saxophone player for the E Street Band.
You're going to get my son to replace me?
No, it's his nephew. It's his nephew.
Okay. I guess I do have a nephew.
Yeah. And so Bruce Springsteen replaced him at first on the next tour. He replaced him with like a whole brass section, not just one saxophonist, but like, you know, a saxophonist, a trombone player, trumpet players, you know, just a whole fleet of brass instruments. And now it's his nephew. Speaking of Springsteen, you know this band Bleachers?
Yeah.
Jack Antonoff of Fun, his latest band. So he played Coachella. I swear to God, he is, he's watched a little bit too much Bruce Springsteen. I know he's from New Jersey, Jack Antonoff, but his show was like a Springsteen show. I was like, well, he's got a saxophone player. He's running around the stage more than any of he's throwing water into the audience. I just thought, wow, he's seen a few Springsteen shows.
Okay.
All right. So the animated classic TV show, The Simpsons, has long been a progressive voice on the Fox Network, no less. The Fox Network. But for years, they faced a growing concern over the stereotypical character of Apu, an Indian man who runs a convenience store and speaks the way one might if English was your second language. There was even a documentary film about the representation of marginalized groups in popular culture titled The Problem of Apu. And how did The Simpsons respond? By making fun of the people complaining. Lisa, who is supposed to be the smart daughter on the show, she's one of the characters, said in a response to a classic kids book whose content was changed over the years, "Something that started decades ago and was applauded and inoffensive is now politically incorrect. What can you do?" And then the show panned to a picture of Apu in a truly 10-year approach to the issue. The showrunner had repeatedly touted the fact that they would be addressing this topic and then ignored most of the negative comments that appeared online. Now, the showrunners say, they'll listen and learn and try and discover a more popular way to deal with Apu, and perhaps, more importantly, the right way. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, that's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but boy, you know, like, people are criticizing you, say, hey, tune in, we're going to talk about it. Oh, we're going to make fun of you, but you'll enjoy that, won't you? I mean, how stupid are they?
Variety has just added a video games editor. That would be Brian Crescente, who will continue to contribute to Rolling Stone while overseeing coverage of the $18 billion market in the U.S. alone. It's good that they hired somebody who already had a job, because there are no out-of-work journalists for them to hire. Meanwhile, the New York Times is making good on a promise. More than a year ago, or January of 2017 to be exact, the gray lady turned up her nose at a bunch of bestseller lists. One of them was graphic novels, but the Times promised to bump up coverage. An industry-wide open letter to the Times pointed out it had been a year and, you know, they were still waiting. Well, now, the Times has added a regular monthly column covering comics and graphic novels with two writers alternating duties, Hillary Shute and Ed Park. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a long overdue in both areas. You know, a video games editor is obviously important for Variety. It's a big, big business. And the Times, you know, over a year later, like, fine, we'll give you a monthly column. I mean, a monthly column is just the lamest thing. They do that for, like, mysteries as well and children's picture books. It's such a nominal attention paid to a category that covers so many different things. It's just sort of almost insulting. Plus, they have two writers. So basically, Hillary gets to write six columns a year. Six articles in a year, you know, big deal. Yeah. That's really not a lot. And you don't get to know her voice. You don't get to know what she wants to cover. Same with Ed Park, you know, six articles, you know, I write that a week.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. But, you know, staying sober, by the way, it may not be easy, but it can be funny. The Peter Farrelly comedy Loudermilk just got renewed for a second season on AT&T's Audience Network. The Ron Livingston sitcom is about a guy who is both a recovering alcoholic and a substance abuse counselor. It's kind of interesting. But Livingston is not a sympathetic ear. He's caustic and uncensored and pisses off everyone around him. The new season launches this fall. Big deal or big whoop?
Two things here. One, have the Farrelly brothers gone their separate ways? Because when I was looking up the credits, and it looks like they're both doing completely separate projects. They don't have anything in the works together, and it seems like it's been a few years since they've done a project. I don't know whether they've just grown apart or, you know, hey, we've done it, or they'll come back at some point or what, but maybe they had a fight. I don't know. I just wondered. The other thing was the Audience Network. What the hell is the Audience Network?
I don't know.
It's some AT&T, I assume, streaming service or something.
When you put this in, I was like, well, I guess that, you know, I guess it's not.
Well, this is why I want to talk about. This is how hard it is for people to get attention. It's season two of Loudermilk, a show I've never heard of, starring well-known people. You know, Peter Farrelly is overseeing it. Ron Livingston is starring it. I actually like Ron Livingston a lot. I find him an appealing actor. And I've literally never heard of Audience Network. That's why, of course, they have new content to try and let you say, oh, I want to check that out. I better subscribe to Audience Network. But dear God, I've never heard of it. That's how many shows and how many services there are. God help you when you're trying to launch a new streaming service. But really, the main thing I said is, can the trades please not turn every renewal into a story? With 600 plus scripted shows and endless reality shows, it feels like every day there's like 50 articles in email newsletters, you know, newsletter pop-ups, this person considering a role, that person considering a role, which seems like they're doing the work of a PR person, not a news organization.
Look, they've got to, there has been a long-held belief that the more you write, the more traffic you get. That is going away, of course, that belief. And, you know, for the trades, they just feel like, you know, you got to write like 20 stories a day. Otherwise, you know, the traffic dips.
But you're not helping me. With 1,000 shows on TV, I cannot have an article saying someone's considering a part on the show. Someone's directing it. The show's been greenlit. It's gone. Season one, it's been renewed. A breakdown of each episode. It's too much. It's too many stories. It's just overwhelming. It just, you know, do a weekly roundup of renewals. And, you know, it's just, you know, Loudermilk on the Audience Network that really needs its separate email. It's too much.
Well, if it's too much, maybe we should move on to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. We've got two legal cases to cover this week. The first involves streaming music online, so Spotify is paying attention. The second involves how top executives in Hollywood and corporate America are paid, often through performance-based bonuses that shareholders of Netflix are contending, you know, is kind of a sham. First, the music, okay? So have you heard of Wolfgang's Vault?
I have.
Yeah, so have I. It's by the way, it owns Pace Magazine, and Josh Jackson, the editor of Pace Magazine, has been a guest here on the show. Wolfgang's Vault is a website that gained access to live concert recordings held by promoter Bill Graham and others. It has posted streaming access to hundreds of shows by the Rolling Stones, The Who, Ray Charles, The Grateful Dead, Aretha Franklin, and many, many others. The Wall Street Journal basically called Wolfgang's Vault an Aladdin's cave for popular music. But did Wolfgang's Vault have the right to stream them?
This is what, you know, I've seen Wolfgang's Vault. I went there years ago when it launched. And I was kind of like, how do they have this? How do they have these concerts by the Stones just sitting on their website? You couldn't download them. You just streamed them. And I'm sure people could rip them somehow. But I just, you know, I was always like, do they have the right to this? I always sort of wondered that. And now, amazingly enough, that's what the music publishers said as well.
Yeah, I guess they're saying you might have the right to the performance, but you don't have the right to the publishing.
Well, they said you haven't cleared the rights to be able to host this concert on your website. It's not a technical night. They're like, you didn't do your job. So the National Music Publishers Association filed suit in 2015. And now a judge has ruled that Wolfgang's Vault had committed massive copyright infringement. Up next is a trial on damages. Why is it important? Well, Spotify is fighting its own lawsuit about copyright infringement. Congress is considering changes to the laws on music licensing, but it may simply be something that applies only to Wolfgang's Vault. It's sort of a weird situation where they got access to all these live concerts. Basically, they were filmed at the time, and then Wolfgang's Vault said, hey, you know, I guess since we filmed it, we sort of made an album as well, and we have the right to it, and we're going to stream it. And the judge said, yeah, just because you filmed a concert doesn't mean you suddenly have made an album and can assume certain rights. But what makes it confusing is they did enter into agreements with three major labels, but the courts were focused on the rights of the artists and the music publishers. Mm-hmm. More confusing, the music publishers did accept payments for years, making damages and consent a murkier issue. We'll have to see what happens when they go to the trial on damages. They'll say, hey, we went to the publishers, we went to the labels, we got it cleared by everybody, we thought, why are we being sued? But I think the takeaway is that the stream first and figure the rights out later stance might come back to haunt you.
Yeah, I don't know. Certainly, look, I've followed Wolfgang's Vault for years because they're owned by, Paste Magazine owns them. Sorry, the other way around. Wolfgang Vault owns Paste Magazine, if I'm not mistaken. Or maybe, I don't know. I think they own Daytrotter and...
Somebody owns everyone.
Yeah, I guess I'd have to figure out, because I know at one point Wolfgang Vault bought them, and I don't know whether they're still owned by Wolfgang Vault. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But...
rights issues are really hard.
Yes, you know, and they're trying to figure out a new music copyright scheme, and Congress can't figure that out soon enough, in my opinion.
Yeah, but you've got satellite radio stations saying, why are we paying a higher fee than terrestrial, or why is terrestrial paying a higher fee than us? What about pre-72 music? We don't have to pay anything for that. And yes, you do. No, you don't. It's a big, big mess. It does have to be cleared up by Congress, ultimately.
Yeah. Our second story is about bonuses. Shareholders are suing Netflix, and they take exception to the explosive growth in performance-based bonuses. So this is like, if the company does well, then you get even more money. And they're saying in their suit, the bonuses for performance should be difficult goals that deserve a reward when they are achieved. Instead, execs get performance bonuses as kind of like a matter of course, and the predicted targets are in fact exactly what should be expected, and they don't deserve a bonus for reaching them.
Yeah, so when you look at what they list out, like quarter by quarter, year by year, what the goal was for the executive to reach, and they reach it exactly or completely. It's like they do it every single time. Like over like the past however many years, there's been like one time where somebody didn't reach their goal, and they're saying that's a joke. And they're doing it this way to pay them this way to make it seem like they're not giving them as big a salary as they are. They're sort of saying, oh, well, your salary is only $1 million, but if you hit this goal, you're going to get another $10 million. Well, the shareholders are saying, yeah, that's a joke. You're actually just paying them $10 million. And they're also doing it perhaps to avoid some different ways of paying involves different tax liabilities. So they're just saying this whole thing is a joke. And it's a noble lawsuit. I think they're going to succeed, but it won't matter because exec pay is a moving target. Used to be stock compensation, then it was performance bonuses. If that falls out of favor, they'll figure out some other way to shovel most of the profits into the pay of the top executives. So no matter what happens with this, I think it's going to be a big whoop.
Yeah, I don't know why they don't, it's like you're going to sue over this? Okay, fine. They'll just change what they call it. They'll just say, okay, fine.
But they don't want them being paid that much money. Like, you shouldn't be paying them $10 million. Well, however you cloak it, you're paying them too much money. So we're suing you because this is a joke. It's a sham that you're pretending they've reached some goal. But they're also going to continue and say, you shouldn't be paying them $10 million. These profits should not all be going to the top few people in the company. We're the shareholders. We want more of the cut.
Well,
loaded executive pay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've always kind of talked about that, but I don't know. Are the people at Netflix being paid too much? They're making,
well, that's what the shareholders believe. And I bet, you know what? That's the, not the people. It's the top few executives.
Right,
I'm sure the employees of Netflix shoving DVDs into an envelope do not feel they're being overpaid.
Correct. And the employee who's shoving DVDs, the DVD, into an envelope.
There's still a lot of people subscribe. I have friends who subscribe to that. They have a lot of movies on DVD you can't find anywhere else. So the long tail of DVDs and Blu-rays at Netflix is really helpful.
I know. It was a joke.
Yeah, I know. I'm
trying to throw a joke in there.
Sorry. All right. Well, now you're trying to joke, and we're moving into the obituary section. So the joke is on you.
Well, speaking of jokes, Mitzi Shore, the owner of the Comedy Store, died at the age of 87, and she is the mother of Pauly Shore. I know that's not her claim to fame, but
it's one of them.
But she's
sort of a mother to lots of people, right? She was a career counselor. She'd make and break careers. She was a person that would offer advice and support, and, you know, one of those people in the industry that the public didn't know, but she was a huge figure to a lot of stand-up comics.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, Jay Leno got his start at the Comedy Store, among many others.
Nobody's perfect. No, I'm kidding. It's just a joke, Mr. Leno. Go back to your motorcycles.
Well, even, Milos Forman directed The Pickle, right? I mean, after...
Everybody makes mistakes.
Everybody makes mistakes.
The Oscar-winning director died at 86. Two of his best Czech films were The Loves of a Blonde and The Fireman's Ball. Both were great. And they were banned after the Soviet Union invaded and occupied Czechoslovakia. He happened to be in Paris at the time in 1968. And he said, you know what? I think I'll move to New York.
Yeah.
maybe not go back to Czechoslovakia.
Well, and he directed One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Amadeus, among others, Ragtime. It's just so many of the People versus Larry Flint. I've interviewed him a couple times.
Actually. Oh, really?
Yeah, he was very nice.
Well, he has a couple major films. He doesn't have a huge career. He has a couple interesting films in Czechoslovakia, and obviously One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which I don't love, and Amadeus, which I do. Ragtime is noble, but it's not nearly as good as the book. The rest are all pretty problematic. The People versus Larry Flint, Hair, you know. But he's certainly an interesting talent, and he had his moment in the sun there for a decade or two. So, you know, he's a cool, interesting provocateur.
And so did R. Lee Ermey.
Yes, that's right. I don't know, but he's the former Marine turned actor. As one person said, I think it was Entertainment Weekly, he'll be remembered essentially for one role, and that's fine. He was the drill instructor in Full Metal Jacket. He died at 74. He was a consultant on the movie, and he really wanted the part. And hilariously, Stanley Kubrick thought he was too nice. You'll never pull this off. So he filmed an audition tape where he was screaming insults at recruits while somebody threw tennis balls at him. I don't know why that would, but I guess he kept his focus so much that impressed Kubrick, and he gave him the part. So that's kind of neat.
Yeah, and if you've ever seen Full Metal Jacket, he is one of the most memorable things in it.
Oh, absolutely. Though it's a great movie, the more I see it, the more it doesn't feel like too... movie split, you know, one movie split in two. It really feels of a piece. The training on Paris Island and then the scenes in Vietnam. I've grown, like a lot of Kubrick films, I've grown to appreciate it more and more over the years, the more I see it.
Did you appreciate Harry Anderson?
I did. I was never a huge fan of Night Court. It was an amiable show. He also had a show called Dave's World. But Harry was a classic TV star, just a very easy, amiable presence on camera, sort of very inviting and warm. He just pulled you in. So he was a really good TV star, and that's not an insult. That's a compliment. He just had that warmth and accessibility, and he was a funny guy. He was a magician and a stand-up comic, and then he broke into acting. He died at 65. One thing I did not know is that as a kid, his parents split up, and Harry traveled around a lot with his mom. They just were not in one place much. And he described her as a hustler, like a con artist, which is kind of fascinating because his big break was as a pool hustler on an episode of Cheers, where he was playing pool and hustling Ted Danson. It was a lot of fun. He was very funny, great patter. And they said, let's give that guy a show. And that his mom perhaps inspired that character on Cheers, or at least his take on the character, which inspired them to put him in Night Court.
And later he did his own show, right? Like Dave's World, I think.
Well, Dave's World was based on the Dave Barry column.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Dave Barry. And then he's a magic story just opened up in New Orleans. He has a stand-up and a comedy restaurant or store somewhere else. You know, he's gone on with his life. He sort of didn't try and, you know, he did two shows, both hits. That's a lot for anybody, so good for him.
And then Art Bell, a late-night radio host, died at the age of 72.
Oh, thank you for Aaron Rich for pointing this out to me. I don't know if I would have spotted it. He hasn't gotten as much attention as he deserved. Art Bell was a really important late night radio show host. He hosted, most famously, Coast to Coast. And that show at its peak probably reached about 15 million listeners a night. He was a really big deal. You look at Larry King and Art Bell. Those are two of the really major names in late night radio. That's how Larry King got his big start. His show was wacky, you know. He would cover everything, conspiracy theories, UFOs, time travelers, the shadow people. He would just basically say, all right, tonight we're going to talk about time travelers. If you're a time traveler, send us a fax or an email or call us. And if you can convince us that you might be a time traveler, we'll put you on the air. And then he would talk to them. And he wasn't making fun of them, nor was he didn't come across as wildly gullible, though he would pretty much accept anything eventually. But he asked interesting, sober questions to people, in a way that drew them out. And so it was just entertaining. You know, even if you thought it was all nonsense, it was just so much fun. There was this guy who called in regularly to discuss Mel's hole. This is the guy's name, Mel. And he would discuss the hole on his property. It was a shaft into the ground of unknown depth and had mysterious properties that couldn't possibly be natural. It just would not happen unless somebody did it. But it was too deep and mysterious to be done by humans. What was going on with this hole? Turns out in real life, no one could actually ever find the hole. It didn't really exist, but it didn't matter. The guy was just a really interesting guy. He quit and retired and came back multiple times. His wife died tragically at 47 from asthma. His son was kidnapped and sexually assaulted by a high school teacher and that's why he left the show another time. Another time he left the show for several years because he said people were roaming his grounds with guns whenever he went on the air, and he felt like they were sending him a message. He needs to get off the air. I mean, crazy stuff happened around this guy. He had a crazy life, some sadness, but he was able to do radio right up to the end. Even though he kept quitting, he was doing his show up right towards the end. I think even 2015 he was on the air somehow or some way. But you know, and when I'm researching him, I'm looking up stuff online and for clips, and I end up on YouTube hearing this episode about the shadow people, which is where you see people out of the corner of your eye, but you don't quite see them. And he asked people to write in if they had experiences with the shadow people, and tens of thousands of people did. And this two-hour show, suddenly I'm on YouTube listening to him, reading off the letters from these people describing their experiences with the shadow people, and it's just fascinating. It's just so, you're like, you just don't know where to begin and what you think about it, but it's a lot of fun. But his most famous moment may be March 23rd, 1994. He had a guy on the air who had predicted previously that on March 23rd, 1994, New York City would be struck with a nuclear weapon. So Art Bell's going to have him on the air and say, all right, this was the day it was supposed to happen. What's going on? So he has the guy on the show. And every year, by the way, they did predictions. Every New Year's Eve, they would have a prediction show where psychics and people would tell what was going to happen in the coming year. So that was just a fun annual thing. So he dealt a lot of predictions, and maybe this guy had been on that annual show. I don't know. But here it is, March 23rd, 1994. You say there's going to be a nuclear bomb dropped on New York. Come on the air. We'll see. Put you on the hot seat. He has him on the hot seat. The show begins, and a headline comes over the wire services saying, from Reuters, saying, Newark has been nuked. That's the headline. Art Bell loses his mind, of course, on the air. He's like, oh my God, you know, like, this is a disaster, of course, in general. Holy, he flips out beyond anything you could describe. And it turns out a pilot flying into Newark saw what was the Edison gas explosion in New Jersey.
Oh,
and
that's when that happened.
It was so fiery and big that, you know, this was the description of the headline. They described what had actually happened in the story, but that's what it looked like in the air. So, you know, they soon figured out what was going on and said, okay, New Jersey has Newark, and Newark have not been nuked, but nonetheless, it made great radio. I listened to it with my dad as a kid. I love to drive late at night. I miss Art Bell.
Well, we're going to miss our listeners for 2 weeks, remember. I'm not going to
We didn't tell them at the top of the show.
Okay, well, for 2 weeks. Next week, there is no show because I am going to be attending CinemaCon.
It's like you have job or something. If you would just focus on this show and make it your life like I have done for our listeners, you wouldn't have this problem.
Well, yeah, you're probably right. But in the meantime, we hope you listen to the show again next week.
2 weeks from now.
So 2 weeks from now, we'll be back. And just so you don't miss it, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review the shows in those podcast aggregators. It helps us out. It helps others find the show. So please do rate and review the show in iTunes or the Google Play Store. Those ways to subscribe to us can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can also be found on our website. That is where you'll find ways to follow us. At showbizsandbox is our handle on Twitter, facebook.com/showbizsandbox on Facebook, I guess. You can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call us and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And all of that information, again, is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group, MGMT. They weren't at Coachella. Their new album, however, has just dropped, and you can purchase it online or stream it online. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's shadowpeople.org, because I just looked it up just to see if it was a real thing, and by God, it is. So if you want to learn more about the shadow people, there it is.
Okay, well, that's a real website. And so is michaelgiltz.com, where all of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading not only this week, but apparently all the way through the end of the year. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until 2 weeks from now, play nice.